Hi, this is Raquel Cohen, staff attorney at the California Innocence Project. I've been working on Joanne Parks' case for nearly 5 years. As a mother myself, Joanne's case has been particularly heartbreaking. Joanne lost her 3 children in a house fire, a tragedy I can never imagine, and then she was wrongly convicted of killing her children. We're still fighting to get Joanne out of prison, where she's been for almost 30 years, where she's never had the chance to truly mourn the death of her children, and where she doesn't belong because she is innocent. Burned, a book by Edward Humes, chronicles Joanne's case and the many disturbing and flawed investigative procedures that ultimately convicted her and many like her. I hope you find the discussion that follows enlightening, but I also hope you find it alarming, and that it leaves you with an urgency to do whatever you can, big or small, to help her and others like her. To start, please consider donating today at CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Alex Simpson. I'm the Associate Director of the California Innocence Project, and thank you so much to everybody for coming to this event. I want to say some specific thank yous to Dutton Penguin Random House for putting together this book, Burned. It's actually on sale downstairs in the lobby if you haven't gotten your copy. It's incredibly compelling, and it's obviously going to be the subject of what we're talking about tonight. I also want to send a special thank you to our incredible volunteers, Kara and Megan, right over here. And our external relations administrator, Jasmine Harris, for putting all of this on. First, of course, I'd like to introduce our moderator tonight, Maureen Cavanaugh. Maureen. For those of you who listen to public radio, Maureen Cavanaugh has been a familiar voice for KPBS listeners for more than 20 years. As the host of KPBS Midday Edition, Maureen has interviewed many notables, including actors Robert Redford and John Leguizamo, and myself, so that's even more. Her most special interview was with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Maureen has received 3 Golden Mike Awards from the Radio and TV News Association of Southern California for economic reporting and breaking news. She also received a Best of Show and Best Radio Newscast Awards from the San Diego Press Club, and the Flow Award from Public Radio Program Directors Association for Best Public Radio Announcer in a Large Market. Maureen is a native of Queens, New York, but after more than 25 years in San Diego, she feels she qualifies as a real Southern Californian. So welcome to Maureen. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everyone. I'm so happy and honored to be here. I'm so happy I was invited by the California Innocence Project to moderate this event. And I want to thank you all for coming. I think that it's going to be a real eye-opener tonight. Burned is a remarkable book. This discussion will be a bit unsettling, perhaps, not for most of you who are here studying law, but for some of you. And it may change your understanding of investigations and evidence, the way evidence is handled in our justice system. So let me introduce our panelists. First, let me introduce the author of Burned, A Story of Murder and the Crime That Wasn't, Edward Humes. He's a journalist and author of 15 nonfiction books, including Mean Justice and No Matter How Loud I Shout, A Year in the Life of Juvenile Court. He won the Pulitzer Prize in Special Reporting for his work on the military establishment in Southern California. Humes' writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, Wired, Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Los Angeles Times, and other publications. He and his family and a menagerie of pets split their time between Southern California and Seattle. Edward Humes. The California Innocence Project team, whose work is featured prominently in the book Burned, is Raquel Cohen. She's been with CIP since 2011. College was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She earned her JD here at California Western. Raquel has played an important role in exonerating many innocent clients and has assisted in helping them receive compensation after their exoneration. Raquel is the project's post-conviction arson expert. and we will hear how she acquired that expertise. And she lives here with her family, her two lovely children, Raquel Cohen. And a special guest tonight, Alan Jimenez, a CIP freed client. Alan was released in 2015 after spending 24 years in prison. He was convicted for the tragic death of his infant daughter, Priscilla. Prosecutors claim the cause of death was shaken baby syndrome. We'll hear that Alan's post-conviction case brought by the California Innocence Project showed that designation, shaken baby syndrome, and the forensics behind that definition were wrong. Alan's case is another example, along with the arson case featured in Burned, where outdated and disproven forensic evidence has kept innocent people behind bars for years. Alan, welcome to our... I'd also like to acknowledge some people sitting in the front, Alan's wife, Diana. Marina Courtney, wife of exonerated Uriah Courtney. And the parents of CIP exoneree Kim Long, Darlene, and Roger Long. Let me start off by asking you, Ed. Okay, so there's a name I haven't mentioned yet, and that's Joanne Parks. That she is the woman at the center of the story in Burns. She was convicted of setting a fire in which her three children were killed. How did you get interested in this case?
Well, it started coming here, trying to see how the sausage was made in the California Innocence Project. We've all read about exonerations. Sometimes they seem to happen on a weekly or daily basis, but how that happens, what that process looks like, and who's doing it. I was interested in learning about that, and in arriving here, of course, I was exposed to the cases, and what grabbed me right away was the Joanne Parks case. First of all, what was happening then, because it was unfolding, so I got to sort of bear witness to that, but also the facts of the case and what its implications were for other stories, other individuals being prosecuted for questionable evidence where it seemed really obvious. So should I summarize a little bit?
Sure. Could you give us a short overview of the facts of the case?
Yeah. The story begins in 1989 in Los Angeles, or actually the small urban island of Bell, California, in Los Angeles County, with a 23-year-old mom accused of murdering her three small children by trapping them in their home, possibly drugging them, and setting the home aflame. Now, you would think in a case of such seemingly monstrous evil that the authorities would want to make every possible step they could take to be certain that their conclusions were just and that the forensic science behind them was rock solid, but that, it turns out, did not happen. 30 years after the fire, 27 years plus after Joanne Parks was sentenced to life in prison, her case has, and many others like it, are raising some serious questions about the technological miracles we've all seen lionized on television shows like CSI. It turns out there's not a lot of science behind many of our forensic sciences, and the certainty, this aura of certainty that experts in these fields bring into the courtroom is all too often a sham. So I started hanging out here, watching this case unfold and realizing that this bigger story was hanging there behind it and was plaguing our justice system and needed to be talked about.
Before we get into the forensic part of this, I just wanted to familiarize everyone with Joanne a little bit more. And you tell us in the book that the family was poor. The Parks family was poor. She had a very difficult upbringing. And her affect was outwardly somewhat emotionless, as was noted by some people in this investigation. How did those traits, do you think, affect Joanne's case?
Oh, I think it played a role, and a number of people have commented that she had this effect of almost a trauma survivor. And in fact, she was traumatized in her youth. She had been sexually assaulted by an older member of her church congregation. The church had covered it up, negotiated a private adoption for the child that resulted from that assault, and which later died in supposedly a crib death. After the adoption had taken place, or foster placement had taken place. And she also had to endure a kind of unique sort of attack that only, I think, women generally face in the courtroom. And she was easy prey for it because of how she, that effect that she assumed was sort of less than emotional. And she was, she didn't cry enough after, her grief was false. She was said to be a neglectful mother, and contrary evidence to that was sort of ignored, and she was turned into the monster parent.
Raquel, you've been working on Joanne's case for many years now. How and when did CIP decide to take on this case?
Joanne's case came to us early in 2002, but there wasn't a lot we can do at the time. The science wasn't there, the law wasn't there, and we did some research on it and had to close it a few times. But then in 2011, the fire investigation world really shifted. It was the first time they addressed negative corpus, which is the inappropriate use of the process of elimination. And we started to see that there were actually foundational issues with the prosecution's case, but we ran into a legal battle, and that is the Richards case that Ed does a great job breaking down. And that case was when California said experts can't make false opinions. And because they had that, we kind of were at a standstill. But knowing that we were going to go in and challenge the law and get it changed, which we did, which I want to give a shout out real quick to Alex Simpson, because he was my everything in this case. He helped me through the litigation, and I think that he also got the law changed, so I couldn't have done any of this without him, so thank you, Alex. So once he got that law changed, we had a few cases that we knew we wanted to address, and this case had been mine and had been on my desk, and we were able to move forward then with the new changes in the science and the changes in the law.
And to explain, to interpret for people who are not attorneys, what Raquel's talking about is that before this law was changed, if you found out that your expert witnesses were wrong in what they said, the law said, well, opinions are just opinions. They can't be right or wrong. And you were out of luck if you wanted to challenge that conviction based on the erroneous testimony of an expert. And CIP went and got the law changed. So now there's a new world for people who are hopefully exonerated. I did want to say, Raquel, this is where you became the post-conviction arson expert for CIP, isn't it?
Yeah, it just happened by chance, but I feel very fortunate and lucky because it's my newfound passion. My first passion is helping those who've been wrongfully convicted, and now I get a little subsection of that and those that have been wrongfully convicted of arson.
How long did it take you to acquire this expertise?
I'm still acquiring it. I would say throughout this, getting the case dropped on my desk and assigned to me, I absolutely knew nothing. I didn't know what I was reading. What was a B pattern? What is lash over? I have no idea. And I had to learn quickly. And Paul Bieber, who's featured in the book, was the first expert that I talked to, and really he was my go-to when I had questions, and he introduced me to all the great experts, including Greg Orbit, and John Lentini obviously wrote one of the first reports, and David Smith I met through that, and so I was able, now I know a host of great experts, and I go to the conferences and really learn the science behind it so that I can better my ability in this next hearing, in this appeal, and also if I get another one of these cases on my desk.
Alan, for people who have not lived through this, it's almost inconceivable to think about being behind bars for more than 20 years for a crime that you didn't commit, or in your case, a crime that wasn't. How did you deal with your incarceration?
At the beginning of my incarceration was, I wasn't doing really well. I was very angry, not being hurt, not being believed. So the first couple years, they were like just full of anger for myself. And later on, having a conversation with my dad. My dad, at the time, he had cancer. And having that conversation with him in one of the visiting rooms, I kind of like bent out. And I told him, you don't understand what it is to be here for not doing, having been guilty of it. And he told me, well, that's where you're wrong. I do understand. My dad was a survivor of the Holocaust. So he told me, being in a concentration camp, he gave me some insight into what it is to be somewhere incarcerated, pretty much, for him. And he told me, find a purpose. Don't let this place define who you are, and don't let this place to change your spirit. So after he died. But thanks to that conversation that I had with him, and I get choked up, sorry about that, is that I did find a purpose. I did find a way to have a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day, and that was by being of service to others. I became a tutor. I started talking to youngsters that were about to go out. You know, they come into prison with 6 months, a year, and they don't know what to do with their lives, so I started to talk to them. I got involved with the church. I started getting involved with the college program. I became a tutor for that, help other guys get their degrees. So for me, being able to have a sense of purpose every day, being of service to others, and have the sense of achievement at the end of the day is what helped me. Besides that, having God in my life helped me tremendously. And of course, I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't have my wife, Diana, my daughter, Yvette, and the rest of my family, my mom, that has always been there for me. My in-laws, they're like parents to me. So because of them and their support day by day, year by year, their visits, and then when the Innocence Project came on board, I mean, I did appreciate, and I still do, every visit from Melissa, from Alex, from Justin, Raquel, and their students. And so I have a very special place in my heart for each one of them. They're my extended family. And for the students, even though they're there for a year or a semester, what they do, it makes a difference. So knowing that I have all that people backing me up, believing in me, and trying to get me exonerated, that kept me going. It's all that together kept me going.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Raquel, we heard from Alan and how he managed to survive. And we heard about Joanne's early life and the trauma that she went through. Tell us about Joanne now. What is she like today?
Joanne may be the strongest person I know and have ever met. She, you know, it's interesting, and I'm pretty sure Alan and some of the family members can relate to this. You meet these inmates, these clients that don't have a lot of hope because they've been failed by the justice system, and you give them a little bit of hope, and that takes them, I think, so far. But then time and time again, we have to kill that hope, and I had to do that to Joanne when we lost. And I saw her dip, and I was really worried about her. It was right around the holidays. It was just very bad timing. But then I saw her come back up. She found a purpose, like Alan said. She found a way to focus in a way that she thinks she can make a difference. She hopes one day she'll get a commutation of sentence and she'll be eligible for parole. So she's focused and put her energy into that. And so you just see a woman who's been through so much, but is very intelligent and very smart and able to pull herself out of the hole and keep fighting and find a purpose and a way to take control of something she has no control over. And so I've seen that with her, and I've seen her really just come back up, move forward, and hopefully I can give her a little bit of hope and pull through on it this time around.
And, okay, let's get into the heart of the matter. This book, Burned, explains the revolution and what we know about how fires burn and how to investigate fire scenes. Can you explain how that new knowledge came about?
Yes. Well, fire investigation for many years had sort of a inherited wisdom that one generation of investigators would pass on to the next, and they were tried and true indicators of how to differentiate an accidental house fire from an arson fire, one that had been deliberately set, the way the fire seemed to spread more quickly or more intensely, patterns that would suggest that gasoline or some other accelerant had been used, the way bed springs would melt. There was a whole checklist of things, and this was part of fire science. There wasn't any actual scientific research behind much of it. It was just things that had been observed anecdotally, written down, and passed on from one investigator to another. In terms of testing whether or not these things really showed what we all were told they showed, that just did not happen. And then Nature created its own test of some of these ideas during the Oakland wildfire in 1991. Actually, right around the time Joanne was arrested, within weeks, this horrible fire took place. It swept through the hillsides above the Bay Area, 3,000 plus homes destroyed, dozens of people killed, and many left homeless. Houses reduced to what they call black holes, burned down to their foundations. And the question fire investigators and fire scientists had was, well, how do we investigate this black hole? We know what caused the fire. We know it was an accident, a brush fire in the hillside spread. The flame spread into the neighborhoods, one house to the next, in a chain reaction. There was nothing suspicious about this fire. Let's go in and look at the ruins and see what we can learn about this type of fire. So they went in trying to expand their ability to understand how houses burn down, how to investigate them. But when they arrived there, they saw in house after house evidence of arson. All these indicators they thought had to be caused by somebody deliberately setting a fire, the way glass cracked, the way cement became pitted, the way plumbing and aluminum thresholds and doorways burned a certain way. All that indicated arson to a seasoned arson investigator. And if they were seeing them in these houses that had burned accidentally. One of the experts in Joanne's case, John Lentini, was one of the fire scientists present for that. He had sent people to prison based upon the evidence of arson he was seeing in this accidental fire. And it changed his life. It horrified him, as it did a number of the other people present, because it was the first tangible proof, the first scientific evidence that what we thought was scientific and how we investigated fires was wrong. And the controversy and the battle over making corrections of some of those ideas is really still ongoing. And one of the issues that came up then and was integral to Joanne's case is this phenomenon called flashover. Right. Not to get into a huge deal about that, but flashover is an intense fire. Everything in a room catches fire, they can't catch fire, and the result is a very confusing and misleading portrait that's different than a house fire that doesn't have flashover. And that was the controversy that we spent hour after hour talking about in the courtroom.
And one point when these fire investigators came back from the Oakland Hills fire and saw these houses that looked exactly like what they would have described as arson fires, they actually started to do some testing on their own and did control fires.
Yes.
to see how fire actually worked. And that's putting science in fire science rather than just experience.
Correct. There was one case in which a man was going to be prosecuted for an arson murder, and he swore it was an accident, and the prosecutor wanted to shore up his case and had fire experts, again, John Lentini was one of them, recreate the fire in a house that was going to be torn down, just like the one that had burned. And the same thing happened. They found all these signs of arson and origin point that was false, and they realized that the accused's story actually ran true. The test verdict determined that his unlikely scenario was the correct scenario. So he was never actually prosecuted as a result. It was an exoneration before the conviction. And there have been tests that the ATF does on an annual basis trying to see if fire investigators can figure out where a fire started in a test facility after flashover occurs, and there is a shocking lack of ability to do that correctly. And they kind of kept this to themselves for many years doing this test. It's like, these seasoned arson investigators can't even tell what quarter of the room the fire started in.
They still keep it to themselves.
Yeah, they still keep. Well, it was many years of annual failure before someone involved in the process wrote a paper, and one of the ATF instructors, and he was vilified by his colleagues for doing so. But it was sort of a revelation to the rest of the world to find out that under certain conditions, our ability to figure out what happened in a burning house just sucks. And they were not admitting this. Instead, experts would show up in court and testify with this, we know exactly what happened mentality, and they're impressive, and they're qualified experts, and people believe them, and people went to prison as a result.
Well, I'm going to ask both you and Raquel this one. How does the new fire science relate to the Joanne Parks case?
At the time of so Ed talked a lot about flashover and burn conditions and damage in a post-flashover fire. At the time of Joanne's case, the experts testified flashover had not occurred at all, and they have a feeling that maybe they knew that this is where the science was going because this is right after the Oakland fire revelation. So they testified flashover had occurred, and in those conditions, and today, even if there's no flashover, it is pretty scientific to figure out where a fire started. They got up, and the defense said no flashover had occurred. There's alternate innocent explanations to what happened, and they mocked the defense team, and obviously they won. And today what we know is that the house did in fact achieve flashover. Everybody agrees. But the state is still digging their heels in, saying even though it had occurred, they still are superior at reading burn patterns, and that they are able to say yes, it occurred, and yes, there was ventilation conditions, which actually is the biggest factor and has recently been tested. And they said we could still read those burn patterns even though those conditions were there. And they don't acknowledge the error rate because for whatever reason there hasn't been, since the 2005 Carbon study, there's been some unpublished studies on post-flashover ventilation control fires and the error rates, but they're not really publishing those. And so we don't have very hard science on it. We just know that they're very bad at reading burn damage and what caused the cause of the burn damage in that kind of scenario. And all those conditions are present in Joanne's case. In fact, her fire burned at least 5 to 20 minutes post-flashover, and there have been no testing done in conditions like that. The most they have done is 3 minutes post-flashover, and I think it was 3 out of 53 people got it right.
Another point that the prosecution experts pushed back really hard on was the idea that there was cognitive bias involved in the way they investigated this fire. Can you explain that to us?
Oh, absolutely. When they first went in to investigate the fire in Joanne's case, everybody believed it was accidental and there was an electrical malfunction. They had no reason to believe it was arson. But then there was a phone call from a disgruntled ex-neighbor of Joanne who said all kinds of bad things about her. She's a bad mother. She definitely killed those kids. And then one of the investigators, remember Joanne had a prior electrical fire in her house. Now remember, she's poor. Her living conditions are not great. It was proven that it was the air conditioning that caused the prior fire. Nobody was at home at the time. Nobody was injured. But when those two pieces of evidence came in, that she was potentially a bad mom and that she had a prior fire, the same evidence that was accidental became evidence of an arson. Nothing physically changed at the scene. It was all the exact same damage that they originally assessed. But this time it was now all proven to be evidence of her guilt. And that is the idea behind cognitive bias. Now, whether they know they did it or they didn't, that's not the point. Cognitive bias at its core is that when you have irrelevant information to the forensic analysis, it's going to affect us because we're human. And if you ask Paul Bieber, he would say, and I would agree, that we should be separating the forensics, the scientist, from the irrelevant information that has nothing to do with assessing burn damage, or in any science, taking the irrelevant information away from the scientist.
Now, Ed, when I said that tonight's talk might be unsettling, it's because not only is there a revolution in fire science, but your book goes into what's been found out about the errors in so many areas of forensic science. You talk about problems with bite marks and fiber evidence and fingerprints. Can you tell us how that has been challenged and in some cases debunked as evidence in recent years?
Sure. Well, there's in 2009, the National Academy of Sciences published a report that basically said, hey, you know, we have all these great forensic scientists, where's the science to back it up? And the reason that occurred was because of exonerations, because there is a forensic science that has huge amount of science behind it. It didn't emerge from the world of law enforcement, as most of our forensic sciences, but came out of the laboratory, and that's DNA comparisons. There's all sorts of peer review, error rates, and statistical analyses, and the science behind it is solid, which is why it doesn't just lead to convictions, it can also be used to undo convictions and to get to the truth of certain kinds of cases where DNA evidence is present. Well, if you look at what was many of those exonerations, maybe about one-fourth of the murder cases that have had exonerations resulting from DNA comparisons, the conviction was in part based on other forensic sciences. That raised it, justifiably so, an alarm bell. What is wrong? And what is wrong is that the rigor behind DNA comparisons is not present in some of the even gold standard forensic sciences that we have now, including fingerprint. How often are fingerprint comparers in error? How do we know a partial fingerprint lifted from a crime scene is really being successfully matched to a known fingerprint? You may remember there was a terrorist attack in Madrid in 2004, a train station bombing, hundreds of people killed. It was an international manhunt for the culprits. And a partial fingerprint was found on one of the unexploded bomb satchels. The FBI got involved, the preeminent fingerprint identification unit in the world, and they matched that fingerprint to a likely suspect, an attorney in Portland, who had converted to Islam, who had represented people accused of terrorism, and was perceived as someone who might possibly be involved in this crime. And sure enough, a senior fingerprint examiner made that declaration, that match, followed by several other FBI examiners who confirmed it. And he was arrested and locked away for 17 days until the Spanish police said, hey, we got the guy, he's an Algerian terrorist, he's in custody. Who's this guy? You got a Portland in jail. He's not the guy. And so they re-examined the fingerprints, and it was a big oops moment. From a fingerprint unit that had testified in previous cases that there were never any errors in our fingerprint comparison. There was no error rate, there's no point in raising that false flag. So what happened? It's the cognitive bias that Raquel was telling you about. These fingerprint examiners weren't coming in blind. They knew who the suspect was, they knew the allegations, and the confirmers all knew that their mentor, the senior fingerprint examiner, had already declared a match, and they agreed with their mentor. What a surprise. And we know it was cognitive bias created by that extraneous information, because they blind tested the same examiners later with the same fingerprints, and they did not find a match. So, it wouldn't seem like it would be controversial to correct that, right? Well, our forensic experts, people who are looking at an arson scene and just supposed to base their opinions on the physical evidence, shouldn't be told this stuff. They shouldn't be told that the suspect is a terrible mother who, you know, wanted to get rid of her kids and maybe drugged her babies with cough medicine. You know, months and months later, of course, the autopsy shows there was nothing, no such thing happened to these children. But that was in the forefront of the minds of the second batch of arson investigators who went to what had been thought to be an accident, walked in there, and they saw signs of arson everywhere. They saw sabotaged electrical cords that they deemed to be sabotaged and appeared to be an incendiary device to their eyes, and that was the cause of the fire. They thought that for a year after the blaze. They thought that indicated the place where the point of origin was for the fire. And then they send a wiring to an electrical engineer, and he says, those space cords didn't start the fire. They were burned from the outside in, not from the inside out. That's no incendiary device. So what would you do if you were investigating a fire and you were told your key piece of evidence with no evidence at all? He said it was a failed incendiary device, and the fire must have been started by hand by a match or something like that in that exact same spot on top of the failed incendiary device, because their mindset at that point was so locked in on what they thought the truth was that everything they saw would be interpreted to support it. That's confirmation bias defined.
I want to go to Alan for a moment, because just like Joanne, you were convicted with false science. Your infant daughter had a host of really terrible medical problems that the jury didn't hear about. And yet you had experts testifying, mistakenly as it turns out, that her injuries were due to shaken baby syndrome. And you're still fighting that battle, even though you've been paroled. Has the new science in your case been accepted by the court?
In some courts it has. In some states, cases very similar to mine, the judge either has thrown away the case or people has been exonerated. And so a lot of the experts that were in my case, forensic pathologists, they have done about face. They have changed their views with the new evidence, with the new science, and it is very difficult when you have some doctors that don't want to change their views. Well, not change, because there's a lot of interest to it, like grants and stuff like that. So it is very frustrating being incarcerated, and you have your attorney sending you all this amount of information saying the science is changing, the medical advancements is proving your innocence. But then again, you go to court and the court refuses to see things for what they really are. And they still ingrained into what was it, the triage at the time. In 1991 to now in 2019, science has made huge strides. So SBS, shaken baby syndrome, has been debunked in many, many cases. And so we're still trying to prove that in court, and hopefully.
So Raquel, do you have any insight as to why there's so much resistance to this kind of new science, this science that can be proven, as opposed to the science that people just thought existed?
That's a loaded question. I think I've heard Ed do a few talks about this, and he nailed it on. He's really nailed it on the head. Okay. Anyway.
Sounds criminal.
The law looks back. It looks at precedent, and science is moving forward. It's always changing and testing itself and trying to disprove itself. And when the law looks back, oh well, in this case we did this, so we should keep doing that. And every jurisdiction is different. So if you're in San Diego and they haven't accepted it, then they're going to look at their San Diego cases. But if you go to, you know, Chicago and they have, Chicago is going to be more likely to accept their precedent. And it's really unfortunate, because it really comes down to your luck. It comes down to the luck of the judge and what they want to do, if they want to change precedent, if they feel like being part of the revolution and the change, or if they're going to just stick with what happened in the past. And so I think that's really what's happening. And it's because we have cases like Alan, exactly the same as his, where they're getting overturned and they're getting compensated and they're going on with their life. I have cases, Joanne's case, I mean the Yale case, the Kristen Budge case, all those cases are almost identical to her. And these people just had a judge and a jurisdiction that was favorable to the change.
If the same evidence, if this happened today, okay, do you think Joanne Parks would have been convicted of setting this fire? In other words, what I'm trying to ask you is, are people still getting convicted on this false evidence?
I don't think she would have been charged with a crime.
Okay.
I don't think that any investigator today would have went in and said, I can prove anything, even if they believed it. And I've talked to a few fire investigators who are in the public sector who say, I would still think it was an arson, but there's no way I could put that in my report based on NFPA 921. In my heart, I would think this person was guilty, but I know I would have to rule it undetermined today. So no, I don't even think she'd be charged.
That's interesting because, Ed, you specifically say that there's no conclusive evidence of innocence in Joanne's case, but you also say there was definitely false evidence used to convict her. Can you explain those two ideas?
I think our only conclusive evidence of innocence in post-conviction cases today is DNA evidence. And I think that's the only thing district attorney's office, judges, everyone accepts as being, okay, well, this was definitely not your DNA and the perpetrator's DNA would be here. We can go ahead and say you're innocent. Unfortunately, most of our cases don't have that. So we can never get up and say there's conclusive proof of anyone's innocence unless there's DNA until any science gets up to that standard.
Ed, does that sort of, that leaves a question mark though, right?
It leaves a lot of question marks. And I'll disagree a little bit because there was experts who testified against Joanne today that you know, said they can take this evidence that from 30 years ago and reach a conclusion that the fire was arson. It was interesting to see that the judges did opinion. It says, well, this is all still highly controversial, so I can't, you know, I'm not going to settle about all the experts. So the, you know, who knows? If that fire occurred today and the investigators were not shielded from extraneous information and they, you know, they believed that they had the ability to look at a post-flashover fire and make that call, there's always an. It seems like there's always an expert who will come and testify to that effect.
I think we're fighting, but I would say that yes, you're right. There is an expert that will. There are experts because we saw that today that will get up and say that. I think in the post-conviction world, when that burden is on the petitioner, it's easier to have that happen. I believe that if we were to take this to trial again, those experts would have a problem in front of the judge being qualified as experts because they're not following the science and they're just disregarding it. Anybody wants to read the transcripts from the evidentiary hearing, the experts on the other side made their decisions because they said so and have no scientific backing to prove that. When you compare that to our experts who say the science could say this or this, but it's more likely an innocent explanation, and they're giving you statistics and they're giving you actual studies they have done. Look at Greg Orbit. He's the most published in burn pattern analysis, and he did an excellent job coming in and describing what caused the burn patterns, and we've since done some studies after that confirmed his testimony. And then you look at the other side, they just said, well, I looked really, really close at the burn pattern, and based on my expertise, which, by the way, has never been tested, I am really, really good, so it's definitely evidence of guilt. And I think that if a jury, if she did get charged, which I don't think she would, a jury would not be buying it today.
I think Raquel just gave us one of the things that needs to be fixed. Judges really suck at limiting the testimony of experts to what they are truly expert at. And this case was riddled with that. So they're not doing their jobs. And there's a judge in Michigan, I think, Donald Shelton, who writes about this, about how judges will admit almost any kind of expert, particularly for the prosecution, as long as it's been done somewhere else. And he said, so, you know, well, you were hinting at before, they really want precedent and they feel very comfortable with supporting it. And so in his opinion, the earth would still be flat if judges had their way because there was precedent.
I wonder, go ahead.
I just want to jump in that when I was reading Mr. Hume's book and talking about bias and difference of opinion of experts, it brought me memories when I was in court and seeing the experts in my case going back and forth. And I would like to read something from you, if I may. It says, the divide over bias has grown as absolute as a religious schism, as evolution versus creationism, as nature versus nurture, or baseball versus football. There is little common ground between the purists who say scientific determination of the origin and cause of a fire scene could focus solely on the physical evidence at the scene, and the practicalists who say proper analysis must be informed by the totality of the circumstances, from the character of the suspect to their potential motives for causing the fire. The two sides are so far apart that they often seem to speak different languages during the ritual confrontations of the courtroom, observing one of them testify while the other side sits and watches is a distinctive spectacle, marked by the constant shaking of heads on one side or the other.
And this is something you've lived through.
Yes. So that's what I'm saying. It's like you have one. I mean, the bias and the difference of opinions of experts.
Raquel, since we're reading from Ed's book, I thought maybe you could share with us part of an essay that Joanne wrote. She writes about what it would be like to get out of prison and what she'd like to do. Could you read us a few lines from that?
My thoughts about the outside is the smell of fresh air, seeing large green trees and the smell of different flowers in the air, seeing all the buildings and signs, some old, some new, watching all the different colors and styles of cars as they pass by, to feel the air against my face, my hair blowing in the wind. Going to the beach for the first time, hearing the crashing of the waves, the seagull squawk, the smell of the ocean's water and the salt in the air. The feel of sand between my toes is going to be a surreal experience. The first time going into a store to shop for clothing, seeing and feeling all the different materials, colors, and designs. Choosing and trying on to find a style that is comfortable for me to wear, walking out with my bag in my hand, the feeling of excitement and joy. Going to the grocery store, walking up and down the aisles, and looking at the different products, labels, and choices I have to make. Walking side by side with us, other customers, and with a fleeting thought, no one knows where I've been, how long I have been locked up, or that I was ever in prison.
Thank you. And that's from Joanne's essay in Ed's book, Burned. Alan, I wonder if, because you're the only one who knows, and you're the only one who can share this, do you have any words of encouragement for Joanne as she sits and she waits and she hopes?
Yes, I do. My heart goes out to Joanne because I know firsthand experience what she's dealing with. Losing hope, regaining hope, seeing year by year go by, seeing your productive years just being gone. So that takes a toll on you. And I will tell her not to give up. Even when it looks like everything's lost, don't give up. Hang on to that little thread of hope and keep doing everything that is positive in there. Prison is a hostile and violent environment 24/7. But within it, you can find peace of mind by doing things that help you stay positive. So for her to continue what she's doing, continue to helping people, to continue to make a difference in other people's lives in there, and her day of freedom will come. And The truth will set you free.
Yeah, I hope so. California Innocence Project can always use donations. But besides donating, what can people do to make sure, to help prevent wrongful convictions and support those who have been wrongfully convicted or guilty?
I think just being educated on the issues is very important in educating others. You can do that by following us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and liking and sharing our posts, coming to our events, just learning about what's going on and reading the stories. It's very easy. Like you said, exonerations are happening every day, and it's easy to get desensitized to it. Just another person walking free, but they have a story. And that story is another stepping stone in teaching everybody what's going on in our justice system, to staying educated. I know a lot of people didn't really know what's going on in politics till recently, till they realized they had to listen. Well, we should be listening to our justice system too. We should be listening to what's going on. And we should care about those people that are incarcerated, even though it doesn't touch our hearts or our lives, because they're people too, and they need our help.
And Ed, Raquel said one of the things people can do is educate themselves. That's what you're trying to do in this book, isn't it?
Yes, I think people are deeply interested in how our justice system works. They like to also see what the human toll of our bureaucratic process is, and Joey Parks and Alan and others who have been through or are currently enduring the process of trying to have their cases given a fresh look and fighting for their freedom is. None of these stories just stand alone. They're all part of a larger evolution, a larger story of some success and some failure in our justice system. I'm continually fascinated by the role that the innocence projects like this one and the others around the country play in bringing these issues out. It was an innocence project that first brought the first DNA exoneration about. The system isn't self-correcting unless somebody is doing the kind of work that's going on here. It has a value that. It's so funny. One of the investigators from the Sheriff's Department was involved in attempting to uphold the Joanne Parks' conviction. Was talking about this exoneration business, as if it was a money-making enterprise. I think I can testify to it not being a money-making enterprise.
I also can.
But there's this feeling from that perspective that it's trying to pull a fast line on everyone and raising issues like cognitive bias are taken very personally as an attack, when in fact it's just a psychological phenomenon that happens to us all and we need to guard it. That's why science uses blind testing for all kinds of other things. The itch cream you buy at CVS has more science behind it in that sense than the evidence being used to send people to death.
And on that note, I see by my timer that it's probably just about time to open up for questions. So if anybody has questions about itch cream or any of the other things that we've been talking about tonight, please feel free. No? Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
What's the current status of Joanne's case?
I'm about 130 pages into the new habeas petition. I am filing in the Court of Appeal. Greg Orbit actually did computer modeling to support the conclusions that we have come to show that to debunk the multiple areas of origin for those of you who read it. Hearing, it's a beautiful report that I'm going to be attaching. But other than that, going up to the Court of Appeal and hoping they see that Judge Ryan got it wrong.
Yeah, this is for Ellen. How did you get connected with CIP? Did you reach out to them? Did they reach out to you?
My wife.
Oh, okay.
She reached out to them, and they came and they responded in through an attorney, Jenny D'Angelo. She's been handling my case as well. But they came and they offered their help and. Ever since I've been with them.
So how long did it take?
What was that, Justin? 2008?
We were young men.
2008, I believe.
This is when it started, and then how long until?
2016. Until 2015. Oh, okay.
That's
actually not a long case. Yeah. We have a case we've been working on that I've been working on for 25 years, and she's still in prison. We have a few cases worked on 15 years, and they got people out. The system works slowly. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Did any of the work that was done on the Todd Whittingham case come into play here? Obviously, he was dead before the fire.
You have a lot of the same issues as the Willingham case in our case, and I believe John Lentini has a part. He was one. So when John Lentini realized he was doing all this stuff wrong in the past and he put innocent people away, he had a group come together and have the arson research committee, review committee, and they went and looked at old cases and would write reports recommending which way it should go, and that's how he wrote for us, and he did that for Willingham. So yes, it plays into the case as much as it can, but again, it's a different jurisdiction, so there's no precedent. And there was actually never, the court never got to file the finding of innocence before he was executed.
Yes.
Towards the end there was the subject of education came up. And I don't know why my mind just flashed back to the Salem witches, you know, when no one was educated about anything. What is being done that you know of to educate the links in the chain, the cops, the prosecutors, the experts, towards making them see it differently in general, or not? What is the general?
There's a lot of criminal justice reform going on right now. Those two sitting right next to you are changing policies right here in California. They last year got the eyewitness bill change where there's a lot of problems with eyewitness identification and using six packs that has been studied. And so they were able to get the law changed to make sure they were following better protocols to reduce faulty eyewitness identification. So there's a movement in the United States, but it's slow, and I think that we just have to keep pushing through and getting laws changed so that we're not seeing these same mistakes being made.
Right, now it's kind of a state-led effort. In fact, Texas, in part because of the Willingham case, has been at the forefront of some of the reform of the science and the courtroom and forensics, arson science. There was a federal effort. Led by the Justice Department, but had sort of everybody involved, the forensics community, the defense bar, scientists. The change of administration has led to the demise of that sort of centralized effort, so it's now in the hands of the states pretty much.
Yeah.
Raquel, how did you first get involved in the California Innocence Project?
When I was an undergrad, I was a criminal justice major, and my final paper, whatever it's called, this long time ago, was about innocent people on death row. My professor threw it out, why don't you research that? And then I learned about, wow, this is a real issue, this is a real problem. And I learned about the Innocence Project in general, and I wanted to come to San Diego for law school. It's one of my first picks. And I applied here not knowing that they had an Innocence Project, but when you apply, they start sending you brochures. And so it all kind of came together, and I focused on coming here because of that.
It was fate. Yes. Yes.
Will you get the same judge when you take this back to court?
Well, going to the Court of Appeal, they could remand it back to the Superior Court for another hearing if they see an issue that they want resolved. But we would challenge that judge.
Any more questions?
I have just one more. This is for Raquel. So are there other countries, I'm specifically thinking of Germany and how they deal with their incarceration, people who are incarcerated, are there other countries that this country could base a model on and reforming how we prosecute people and send them to jail or prison?
That's a good question. Yeah, I'm gonna defer.
There are lots of countries we could defer to, but one of the problems in the United States, which makes this country so unique, is we not only have 50 states, criminal justice policies are set at the state, county, and local level. So in other countries, like when the shaken baby syndrome stuff came out, they would create national committees to reform the laws. So in the UK, they looked at all the cases in the country, and they had the power to change all those cases and reverse them. One of the problems in this country is because we have all these jurisdictions and all our politics are local, that it's up to your local DA. So we have to fight these cases state by state, county by county, DA by DA, and that's why reform is so hard in this country. And we could talk of all the good things of having different states, because Texas can be Texas and California can be California, and maybe this union is held together for 250 years because of that. But it's very frustrating criminal justice. For instance, the ID issues you were talking about earlier, San Diego adopted the reforms in ID years ago, but LA has refused for many years to change the way they do ID procedures, and many people have been wrongfully convicted. They've paid out tens of millions of dollars in lawsuits as a result, and so 100 miles apart in the same state, they're following completely different criminal justice policies, and that's very typical across the United States. So there are great models from Europe, particularly Northern Europe, but getting those changes made is very, very difficult. And almost all criminal laws at the state crime level, federal criminal law is a very small part of criminal law, and that's the only part that can be changed nationally.
Thank you all. Thank you all. And thank you, Alan, Ed, and Raquel.
I want to thank him from Marine Capital. Thank you so much.